My name's Rebecca Parker, and this is part two of a reflection together called Beyond Submission, Reimagining the Relationship of the Soul to God. And this afternoon I wanted to start out by telling you a dream that I had when I first was exposed to feminist theology. When I was in seminary, we were required to read some books by Mary Daly, and I read a book called Beyond God the Father, and it was an extremely upsetting book to me, because in that book she looks at our traditional images of God and suggests that not only are they not very good images, but they're destructive and dangerous images. And this was a completely new idea to me, and it was really unsettling. I think not an uncommon reaction. Well, I went to sleep one night before class when we were going to discuss this book, and this is the dream I had. I dreamed that I was walking along a very busy city street, downtown city street, in a kind of rainstorm after it had snowed. And so the streets were covered with melting snow, and it was all really slushy, and the sidewalk was muddy. And I was walking along with my then husband, who at the beginning of the dream graciously had me walk on the outside and he walked on the inside. It was a reversal of the, he said, here, you walk on the outside. So I was walking on the outside and the cars were coming by and all this wet, icky slush was splashing on me. And this was really uncomfortable. So I said to my husband, let's walk down the alley and get away from this traffic. So we turned into an alley. And as we began to walk down this alley, and as we walked, I noticed that like most city alleyways, there were garbage cans and doorways, dark doorways. And as I looked, I saw that in every doorway that we were passing, there was a transient standing, a bum. And the bums, they were standing in the doorways, were dressed in raggedy clothes, and they had staring eyes, kind of almost zombie-like. And they looked hungry and cold and tired, and they were standing very still in the doorways, which was kind of menacing and frightening. And as we continued to walk down the alley, I noticed they were in every doorway. And then I realized that silently, the bums were all coming out of the doorway and walking behind us. Till looking back, I saw there was this gathering crowd of, to me, terrifying figures. And I decided, well, we'll just keep walking because pretty soon we'll come through to the other end of the block. And we kept walking and we came suddenly not to the other side of the block but to a closure in the alley. And the alley ended with a wall. And in the wall there was a door. And I looked back and now this whole crowd of bums was drawing up quite closely to us and was all around us. And it was clear to me that we had two choices. We could open the door and go through and see if there was a way out, or we could turn around and face all of these bums. Well, I could see the danger of the bums. It, to me, was very dangerous, and I was terrified. And so I decided the only hope was to open the door and hope that I could get through. We could get through. So I opened the door, and before I had time to cross the threshold with my husband, I found myself across the threshold, and the door closed behind me, and I was all alone. Mm. And it was really, really dark. It was pitch black. And then I saw there was a little bit of light glowing, like the kind of greenish white light, like is given off by the dials on a See in the Dark watch. And in this light that was glowing, I could see that there was a figure standing in front of me. And it was the king of the bums, also dressed in shabby clothes and I was face to face with the king of the bums. And then I looked down and I saw that the light was coming from a piece of paper on which words were written in that effervescent Greek, what is it? Effervescence, not the round word. Fluorescent. 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 Green letters. And I looked, And I could, and the words came into focus, and I read what it said there. It said, God is so tender, sometimes she is called green. And that was the end of the dream. I thought about this dream when I woke up. It was really a nightmare. That was the end of the dream because I was so terrified. And I thought a lot about the dream later when I woke up, and I realized that part of what the dream was telling me was it was telling me how difficult and threatening and scary it was for me to imagine God in any way differently than how I had always imagined God. That just to introduce the idea of God being different than how I had imagined was terrifying. Now, I think since then, a lot of us in our faith communities have become aware of the idea that perhaps our notions about God need to be expanded and stretched out. You remember that there's that great scripture that in the prophet Isaiah where the word of God is, move the pegs of your tent further out and make a bigger tent, stretch out. And I think we have really heard the critique that women have brought to theology that our images of God have been perhaps too dogmatic, that our images have become graven images. We have said that we've imaged God in predominantly male terms. We're all familiar with this. And predominantly in images of authoritative, overwhelming power. King, Lord, ruler, master, and father, though it has a somewhat different connotation, has often carried with it the associations of the domineering, disciplining, ruling father. And we are all aware now that these have been the graven images of our tradition. And I think most of us have recognized that when we make our images and names for God into graven images, then we have limited our openness to the fullness of God. We've boxed God in, and we've said God can only be these things. And we close ourselves off from experiencing God in ways other than what those images suggest. So we have been in a lot of our different communities trying to broaden our images. We've tried to recover the breadth and diversity of the biblical images, which also imagine God in other ways other than just male. I once asked some Sunday school children if God was male or not, and I asked them if they thought God was male or if God was both male and female, and one of the 9-year-olds said, well, neither of those things is true. And the child explained to me that God was male and female and neuter, he said. He said, because God created everything, this was his logic, God created everything, so everything tells us something about God. He said, God is like a rock, and God is like the wind. And, well, he was right. You know, in the biblical literature, the Bible uses all those images for God, as well as the God as father, ruler, king, master. So we have opened ourselves to broadening our images for God out of the knowledge that broadening our images is going to open us up more to the fullness of God's mysterious reality, which is beyond any one of our names or images. But this dream taught me something else too, which I've only come to think about more recently. And that is that it presented a different image of God to me than the ones that I had had. I think up until that time when I had that dream, I had thought of God mostly as a loving father. In fact, my own father, who is a very loving and wonderful person, used to, on Sunday mornings, after when he was shaking hands with people after church, I used to stand next to him, and he'd put his hand on my head when I was a little girl, and he'd shake everyone else's hand. And I always felt really great there when I was, all the people in the church were coming out, my father had his hand on my head, and that feeling of my father's hand on my head became my central image for my sense of God's presence with me. Even as a young adult, I'd go to sleep at night and I'd imagine God's hand on my head, and that sense of love and affirmation that I had felt as a child was my sense of God. But in this dream, I was asked to imagine God as really what the image meant. God is so tender. Sometimes she is called green, was that God was like a little blade of grass or wheat just coming out of the dark loam, and fragile and vulnerable, something that might get stepped on or not noticed. Well, what I realized was not only was the dream suggesting to me that God maybe is vulnerable and fragile and fresh and alive, but if that's who God is in the dream, who am I? In relationship to that blade of grass or wheat. I thought of myself as the blessed child of a loving father. But this dream was asking me to think of myself as I don't know what. It told me that to find God, I had to look in a scandalous place. A different place than where I'd ever looked before, in a scary place, in a place where of outcasts, maybe in an outcast part of myself. And it also told me that to relate to God, maybe I had to see myself as a nurturer, as a gardener, whose responsibility was to make sure that nobody yanked out that blade of grass. And it suggested to me that God's presence in the world is maybe something like a fragile new life that's emerging in a context of deprivation or tragedy, which is the context of so much of our world, a context of hunger, of violence. That maybe God was a presence of vulnerable life emerging in those situations of tragedy and need, and that emergence of freshness and life needed to be protected and seen and cared for. So my role in relationship to God was to see the presence of new and fragile life and to protect it, like a gardener or an environmental scientist or a member of Greenpeace or something. So what this dream told me was that I need to also look at how I see myself, the images I have for myself. And this is what I would like us to focus on a little bit. I think just as our images for God can limit God's nature, close down God or box God in, our images for ourselves in relationship to God can limit our possibilities and close us off from aspects of ourself or from what we're able to do or be. And so as we have opened our hearts and minds to expanding our images for God, we also need to look at expanding our images for our soul or ourself in relationship to God. Now, you can think with me about some of the traditional or typical ways we have imaged ourselves in relationship to God. I made a little list when I was thinking about this. One of them is you might want to suggest some. Let me suggest a few and see if you can add any. One of them, very traditional ones, is we think of ourselves as a child who's carried by God, held by God, loved and nurtured by God. Another one is we think of ourselves as a hungry person who is fed by God. In communion, we're fed. Or as a person who needs to be nourished or nurtured. And we expand on that image in a lot of ways. We're fed the bread of life. We're fed the cup of salvation. We're fed forgiveness. We're fed all sorts of things. But we see ourselves as hungry. Another way I think we sometimes see ourselves is as a lover, a beloved being loved. You find this in the classic mystics, like St. John of the Cross is writing. He always imagines himself as God's beloved, and his poetry is very erotic, but receptive. He is being loved by God. God is coming to him, touching him, embracing him, and he's receiving love.
Jesus is the bridegroom.
Yeah, you offer some other images. We see ourselves. Yeah, that's a continuation of that image. We see ourselves as the one, as the bride, being married. Can you think of any others? Traditional images of how we see ourselves, or maybe how you've seen yourself. Just don't give any illustrations that are fresh and new. I want some old, tired, familiar ones.
Sheep.
As what?
Sheep.
Oh, yeah. Okay, the shepherd, and we're the sheep. Mm-hmm. And we're being led to the pastures and corralled and trimmed.
Sinners.
We see ourselves as
sinners, just people who are
in need
inclined
of,
towards bad, the bad, the wicked.
Yeah. Part of some of the baptism imagery is that we see ourselves as a dirty garment that needs to be cleansed, or a dirty body that needs to be cleansed.
A branch that needs to be pruned. Or the nature,
yeah.
The reference to nature that way. It,
yeah.
We are the branch. God is the pruner, the gardener.
Yeah. Okay.
From that, parts of the body.
We see ourselves as parts of the body. Yeah, that's another image. And God holds the body together. Another one in classic mysticism is to think of yourself as a hard metal. It needs to be melted in the fire of God. We use that language is in our hymns. And I mentioned the other, our first class, another image is of ourselves as clay that needs to be molded by God. We have that image from Genesis too, that in the beginning we were clay and God molded us into life. Okay, those are some of the traditional ones. I think we need to remember the issue isn't whether those are good images, but whether they leave anything out. Okay? There are times when what we most need is to be in touch with ourselves as a child who needs to be comforted or held, or that we are hungry and need to be fed. But a lot of our, I would make this observation that an awful lot of our traditional images, if there's anything that's dominant about the images, it's that they image us as in need. We are people with needs, so that's not inappropriate. But we don't have as many traditional images for ourselves as having resources for giving and doing. We have, even though, interestingly, we live in a culture where the predominant image of what a good human being is that a good human being is somebody who accomplishes, is the macho self, as Jeff was talking about. Good human being is the one who doesn't need anybody else, who can take care of everything themselves and is in charge and stands alone and all that. But in our religious imagery, maybe it's partly a balance, but predominantly our imagery is of us as supplicants. I sometimes think just of an image for all of our images. An image for all of our images is a gesture like this, of help, of come to me, I need you. I think these images sometimes function there are two problems with these images, I think. One of them is that for those who are, I think I've learned as a pastor that for those who are who have been most in need in their life. The images don't always work. This is kind of a hard point to make, and it doesn't, not true for everyone. I think especially about, I was commenting about this last night, especially about people who have been victims of physical or sexual abuse. These are, and the statistics about abuse tell us that maybe as much as 30% of our population are people who have experienced significant abuse in some form. That's a lot of people in our churches. And if you have been one who was humiliated by the overpowering action of another, either through physical or sexual abuse, then to have a religious experience in which the primary image for who you are is that you are a victim can serve to reinforce the feeling that that's who you are, that's all who you are. Or as you mentioned, the image of ourselves as sinner, and children often respond to abuse by thinking that it's their fault that it happened to them. They think that the reason they're getting whipped with the belt is because they are really bad. And then if they go to church and are told that this is what it is to be human, all human beings are really bad, they may not hear anything else. Whatever, the word that we're forgiven by God or loved by God may not get through. All they hear is the reinforcement that they are no good. That's who they are, is a sinner. The other side of it is that if you have been had the experiences that humiliated you to the point of feeling like you were, so that it's deeply ingrained in you that you are unworthy, that you are no good, that you are, and where you have been forced into helplessness, the only counterpart you know to your helplessness is a domineering and violent person. If that's been your experience. So if you go to church and the images are there that we are all children and God is our parent, what that means to you is that you are, is that to be related to God is to be connected to a domineering, violent person. Or to be intimate. If your experiences of, if you were violated as a child, sexually, then to be intimate, and you know, our religious imagery talks about us being intimate with God, being embraced by God, being close to God, God being touching us. All of that symbolism is symbolism of dominance and violation. So for those for whom that has been the experience, has been a life-breaking experience, the imagery can prevent the possibility of healing or transformation. Instead, reinforces it. I remember one woman who came to eventually be part of a church that I served in Seattle, telling me that she wanted to come to church because she knew. She told me that she had been sexually abused by her father as a child, and she wanted to come to church, but she came once or twice. This was before she'd come to our church, and when she got to church, all the hymns and all the language was about God, the Father, the King, the Master, and the Ruler, and she said the language awoke such terror in her that she couldn't stay. She had to leave. And then she said when she first heard about our church and thought maybe it was a place where she could come, she came several Sundays and couldn't bring herself to cross the threshold into the sanctuary because it was like crossing the threshold into the the bedroom, she said. With her language, like crossing the threshold into the bedroom where my father abused me. So that those experiences we need to listen to and take seriously.
Something along those lines. Rob was explaining the first book of Peter and Peter's call for people to accept suffering, mm-hmm. which is directed to the early church because, you know, they were being persecuted, and it's basically his thing to hang in there, you know, and you'll get a heavenly reward. But that's another, you know, if that applied to abused people or applied to third world people, mm-hmm. has been horribly misused to say you just passively accept suffering, mm-hmm. you know, to keep people on the situation. It's good advice. It may have been very good advice for early Christians, but it's very poor advice for people who are oppressed.
Yeah, as Rob points out, the context always determines what the meaning is. And in the context of the threat of persecution, the text may have helped people hold fast and have courage, but mm-hmm. when there's ongoing, well, I'm just repeating what you're saying. I agree with you. But those examples I was just saying are among the most tragic life experiences, and some of us have had those kind of tragic experiences, or people close to us have, or we counsel or work with or pastor people with those experiences. But also I think for those of us who maybe have mercifully escape from that kind of suffering. I still think there are many ways in which the images subtly of ourselves as primarily receivers subtly affect our sense of what we're, of the fullness of our life and what we're capable of doing. One that comes to my mind is another image we have is of ourselves as a listener. God as the speaker, and our job is to listen. God speaks, we listen. We listen and do. And we may never think of ourselves as being capable of speaking, because we're listeners. And speaking is something that the one in power does. I know that for me, my friends who know me well know that I talk a lot and stuff. But up until I was about 24, I never said anything. I went all the way through graduate school. I never asked any questions in class. The faculty had a discussion about me one time because all of the professors started asking me in class to say something. In all my different classes, I can just see them in the faculty room saying, "We have to get this person to talk." And I would never make a comment. I would never ask a question. I never say anything. And then when I was ready to graduate, they asked me to make a speech. And I'd played my cello in public, but to tell you the truth, I had never spoken in public, and I said, "I can't do that." And they said, "You're about to become a minister, you have to talk." But I had seen myself as a listener. As a student, I was a listener, and in the way I related to God, I was a listener. And I appreciated the points in the sermon last night that's something I never imagined myself as doing. And my life was limited by that. And I found as a pastor working with people, when one of your jobs as pastor, or if you're in lay leadership in your church, you're always asking people to do things. People are always saying, "I can't do that. I can't teach Sunday school. I couldn't." Or that people say, "I can't read in church." People say, "I can't do anything about world hunger." Something needs to be done about this, but I can't do it. I don't have the skills. We can't imagine ourselves taking part or acting. In fact, in the most pernicious forms, we reinforce our passivity with the images. I'm a sinner. I can't do anything good. I've learned last time I worked with Lutherans, a Lutheran joke about the Lutheran and the Methodist got to heaven. You know this joke?
No.
Lutheran's clergywomen told me this joke. The Lutheran and the Methodist got to heaven, and they were standing in front of the gate. St. Peter was there. St. Peter said to the Methodist, "Tell me what you've done to deserve to come into heaven." And the Methodist said, "I've dedicated my life to doing good good works. I've tried to feed the hungry and clothe the naked, and I served on the board of the emergency feeding shelter and this and that. And St. Peter says, that's great. Come on into heaven. And then St. Peter looks at the Lutheran and says, what have you done to deserve to come in heaven? And Lutheran says, I have never done any works of righteousness in my whole life. I've never done anything by work. I've never done any works. I've just had faith. And this didn't make you laugh. Maybe I didn't tell the joke right. But the point, the Lutheran clergywomen I was working with were trying to enlighten me as a Methodist that part of the Lutheran tradition was that you don't see yourself as capable of good works. Only God can do good. Maybe this isn't true. Maybe they didn't educate me well enough. But God can do good. But we are sinners. We're, no matter how hard we try, we're incapable of doing good. But we use this to reinforce that we can't do anything about the problems in the world. And in the most extreme forms, we say, and we've heard this in public policy even, or we've heard people say we don't have to take care of the environment because God is going to take care of everything. God's going to end this wicked world and create a new world. God's going to do everything, and our job is to wait. But that image of ourself as the receiver is limiting our life. And it may be limiting us affirming, exploring, and using our gifts. So, I think I've made my point about that. So what I wanted to do was suggest a couple different images for our soul, or maybe just one, to encourage us, and then we'll talk. I'll suggest this image really quickly. To commit ourselves to expanding our images of ourself, to include images of interaction and productivity, as well as receptivity, and images that make our relationship to God some involve a kind of responsibility. That I guess that my dream already introduced one of those images, the image of ourselves as the gardener, the caretaker, the steward. It's a biblical image, actually. Jesus even suggests that God's presence in the world is like seeds that have fallen on the ground. And the usual interpretation is, so we should take care of what kind of ground we are. But maybe we should take care of how we care for the ground and whether we let the seeds grow and discern them. So that's an image where we take responsibility. Another one that I wanted to suggest that some of us were talking about is the image of ourself as a tree. And if you think about the tree image, that's also biblical. In the first psalm, the person open to God is like a tree planted by the streams of flowing waters. We heard that image yesterday morning too, or 2 mornings ago. In the longest metaphor, longest sustained metaphor of the week. But the tree, if you think about the tree as an image for yourself, the tree is in some ways solitary. It's singular. It stands alone. But the tree, though it stands alone, is interconnected with the whole universe. And the whole universe is connected to it. These are things you know. The root of the tree goes down into the soil to draw up the water. And the branches of the tree and the leaves on the tree are stretched out. I guess I'm imagining an oak or a maple tree or something. You could think of yourself as a pine tree if you wanted to. The branches are stretched out and are designed to receive and process the sun, which is 365,000 million miles away. How far is it? Something like that. So the tree is taking something in from a source of life that's beyond it, distant, and also a source of life that's immediately close to it, the water. And if you stretch your imagination, you can see how the tree is really drawing the whole universe into itself. The light of the sun, and the sun is connected to all the rest of the stars. It's drawing on that fire, it's drawing on the soil, it's drawing on the water. It's bringing all those things together inside itself. And inside itself, it's processing all of those things in a way that produces growth and fruit and oxygen. One of the great things about trees is that it's none of their business to care for us. Their business is to grow and to produce fruit and reproduce more trees. That's their job. But doing their job, they minister to us because they make all the oxygen that we breathe. And so they are graciously serving the universe without even having to worry about it, which I think is a really wonderful thing.
They're providing shade.
And they're also providing shade, yeah, sometimes. Fruit. Now, I was talking to Bob about the tree, and the fruit is more than is needed to reproduce the tree. There's extra fruit. People can eat it, birds can eat it, insects can eat it. So the rest of the life forms are sustained by the tree, which is just doing what it's supposed to be doing. Which is that, it's a very gracious image of productivity, because sometimes we think of ourselves as, well, if we're going to do something, what we have to do is save the whole world. And that's really discouraging. So we stop doing anything. But the tree isn't trying to save the whole world. It's just trying to grow there and do its thing. But by faithfully doing its calling, living its life to the fullest, reaching down deep with its roots and paying attention to where the sun is every day, by faithfully doing its calling, it is contributing to the health and abundance of the whole creation. So I think it's a gracious image. But there's some other things about the tree that we can apply to our self. The tree has bark. It has something that protects its inner life. If its bark is peeled away, it doesn't have that protection, it can't live. And we also need some protection for our inner self, our inner sanctuary, so that we can do the work we need to do, the thinking, the reflecting, the gathering of strength, the planning, the choosing. And if we don't have that inner sanctum protected, if we're too vulnerable or too open, then we can't function. That protection is peeled away. But though the tree has protection, it's also always intimately connected to everything. Another thing about trees is a danger for trees is that other trees will take their space. A tree has to have its space. And if other trees crowd it too much or want its place, the tree is overshadowed and can't grow. But also, trees often grow in forests, communities. In fact, the fir forest depends on the protective shelter of the secondary forest, the alder forest. Before the fir forest can get established, all those seedlings have to be protected by the alder trees, which finally pass away and grow somewhere else in some other clear cut. So though the tree has its own space and has to have it, it's not self-sufficient, but is interdependent and related to the others. That's also, I think, a helpful image for our souls. What else might we say about the tree? Another thing I like to think about in the tree image is the way you can think of the things that nurture the life of the tree as symbols of God, the water, the soil, and the sun, which are beyond the tree. The tree has to receive them. There's the receiving. But the tree in its life also contains all of those things inside of itself. The sun is in the leaves. taken into the leaves, and the water is in the trunk and in all the branches. And the soil is, the elements of the soil are present in every particle of the tree. So it, with the tree image, you have an image of God both beyond and within, or of, and of interaction. So that's another way of thinking of the soul that I think is a...
I thought of one more.
Yeah.
Can't remember whether you mentioned it, but when to shed what it's going to shed.
Oh, that's right. That's another thing about trees is they have cycles and seasons. Yeah, yeah. And they're always growing. A tree that's alive is always stretching and expanding, and it's either producing or conserving or all of those things again. Well, maybe I'll conclude these things by reading a poem that a friend of ours has written about what trees do. Then we'll have some more sharing. This is a poem by Carol Sams, who's the other composer in residence at the church where George and Bob work in Seattle. Inside the branches of a pine tree, there is a wooden rocket headed for the moon. Bugs and spiders holding to the bark are in for a big surprise. This is a grand ambition for a vegetable. And you, what will you do? Now I'll sit down. And I'd like to invite you to do some reflecting or sharing about the things I've had to say. Are there ways that you are aware that you have imaged yourself that has limited you, or you've seen other people doing that, or are there images that have become meaningful to you that helped you expand and be more interrelated and productive? Or do you have anything else to say?
Yeah. Well, I have a question about this image, which I like very much, but I'm now thinking about that person that you're counseling who has, in my mind, now the image of lightning having struck them when they were a sapling and torn the bark off of them violently.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still thinking about that person and wondering how, I mean, I can see this image, great, but how is that person now who has the lightning stripped off their bark and they don't see, they don't at the moment when you're counseling, at least at the beginning, they don't see fruit.
Mm-hmm.
How do they get from the image of the experience that they have had to the image of the tree that's thriving and bearing fruit?
Yeah. Well, my experience working with people who've been abused is that every person, for one thing, every person has to, it's a long road to healing, and every person struggles to find both the understanding and the images and the choices that are going to help them be whole. And sometimes the image that's helpful is the one of a protective, caring parent. Sometimes that's what heals, but often I have used the image not of a tree but of a seed with people who've been victims of really painful abuse, and I ask them, do you feel like in everything that you've I say, can you imagine that inside of yourself there is a seed of life that you are holding tightly inside and protecting in spite of all the things that have gone on around you? And usually, when I've asked that question to people, they say yes. They have a feeling of inner holding to something. And I say, so I suggest to them that they imagine that seed of life is a power of life that nothing has ever succeeded in destroying. Or it could be like the root, would be like the Jesse tree. You could imagine that, like when the Jesse tree was cut down, that maybe the another way to work with the image is there any life left in the roots? Is there any water that you can reach? Is there any power in your bark for heat? But usually the images have to go deeper. Mm-hmm. But people respond, it's a pretty healing image to the of a seed within. I say, can you imagine that seed of life beginning to grow? That life beginning to transform you inwardly and come out. And people, just the affirmation that that seed is there is often quite helpful to people. Because people's, the drama of abuse is a drama of burying the life very deep. So images of life buried that could come out. Images of death and resurrection are sometimes helpful to people who've really suffered abuse. I like to use the image of Jesus inside the tomb, coming out from inside, breaking out from the tomb inside. I say, can you imagine that there's any life force inside that rock that can break out, or that can break through the asphalt, or the image of bamboo coming through concrete? And that's a good image for people to work with. And they also, the image is good for a couple reasons. One, people can sometimes, of course, not everybody, even images don't even make sense for everyone. Some people transform their lives not using images. But for a lot of times, the imagination is very helpful in the healing process. People can name the things that are keeping the seed from growing. They can say, well, I know if I let this seed grow, this is what's going to happen to it. So then you can say, well, how, is there anything you can do to protect the seed? So is there any way you can be the gardener of your own seed? And often people can think of, they can think of things they can do. They get, it's surprising how creative people get. I had to do my clinical experience as a seminary student in the locked ward of a psychiatric hospital. The locked ward was for the people who were severely mentally ill and were a danger to themselves or to others, or were so disoriented that they were in a catatonic state. And I was assigned to work with a person who was catatonic. And she couldn't, she sat in the chair, you know. She was a minister's wife. And she'd had a breakdown and become catatonic, and she'd sit in her chair, and you'd smile at her, and there would be no response, and you'd talk to her, she couldn't respond. You'd touch her, and she'd go like this, and so one day, but I knew her story, and so one day I said to her. Could you get up and walk for me and show me in your walk how you would feel if you were really happy and free? And by gum, she got up and she walked. She walked like this. And then she came back and she sat down. And I didn't work with her long enough to, and I didn't really have the skills to know how. But I did at least report that experience to the head psychiatrist, because it was a discovery to me that not all the rest of the aspects of herself were closed down, but she could use her imagination in a nonverbal way. It was fascinating to me. And the really dramatic stories of how deeply people are bury their sense of self who have been physically or sexually abused, the stories of how people, sometimes people even forget their experience, they just are closed down, and how the memories come back to them, and how the feelings are opened up, often do have to do with imagination, so the images are important.
I'm curious about people's yours and your images for God. I mean, I guess for a God, the God that's, for a God without as well as a God, the immanent God, the, mm-hmm. the mysterious God as well as the God in all things. I guess mm-hmm. I'm agreeing with Peter Steinke that we need a, can't just have God just in rocks and sun and stars and everything. Mm-hmm. It needs to be a mysterious, you know, facet to God, or the surprise of God, as Matthew mm-hmm. Fox calls it. I'm just wondering what images, I mean, for me, I'm just discovering Jesus Christ as an image of God, and mm-hmm. that's very useful, and that's, you know, traditional.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also very curious about alternative images.
For the mystery of God?
Or just other images? For God. Yeah. You know, what images people yeah. use for God.
I think for some of the images that I've found rich, one of them I find really rich is the night sky, the dark sky filled with stars, or darkness. We have, in our tradition, darkness is often associated with evil, but I have a very positive feeling about darkness. Darkness is the place of dreams, and darkness at night when you can see the stars is the place where it's most clear to us that we live in this multi-dimensional, mysterious universe. And I mean, I don't know what's going on. I mean, every one of us human beings looks at those stars way out there, and we don't know if there's any more planets or any more people or any more life anywhere in the universe, though I think probably there is. But it's, the night is a place of real mystery and richness, and I like that image of God as the starry night. And there's that Van Gogh painting called The Starry Night. It's got all this. Then I also really like the image of God as the artist, which is in the book of Genesis. You have God creating human beings by molding them out of clay, and this idea of God making things. There's a beautiful medieval illuminated manuscript that has God as a mathematician measuring out the stars with a, what are those things we use in school to draw circles?
Compass.
Yeah, God with a compass measuring out the distance of the stars. And I like that one. I also like the image of God as a cook, which you have in the 23rd Psalm, "Thou preparest a table before me." And in the movie Babette's Feast is about this woman who makes the fantastic feast for all these ascetic Danish people.
Lutherans probably.
If you haven't seen this film, I really recommend it to you. And Babette is an image of God for me, because she brings this, she cooks up this incredible feast and serves it to all of them. And in spite of their efforts, they enjoy it. Efforts
Your
not
grace.
To. And there's a lot of biblical images of God cooking. Well, at least there's the 23rd Psalm. Anybody want to add any other ones? Those are human images, the artist and the cook and the mathematician.
Your gardener image reminds me of one that correlates with the cook. And I wonder if in many churches it just spontaneously comes up that although we're sinners and we can't do anything right, once we're making the coffee after service, we can do things.
Yeah.
Good cookies, or can keep the church looking tidy and things, and that perhaps that's a ministry as much as gardening the little blade of wheat.
Yeah. I just left a parish assignment where I was only for a couple years on an island in Vashon, in Puget Sound, Vashon Island. And of the 2 years I was there, I think the favorite sermon that I preached to the congregation was a sermon when I talked to them about the strawberry festival. Every summer, this church, there's a strawberry festival on Vashon Island. Well, nobody grows strawberries on Vashon Island anymore, except for one farmer. But the people at the Methodist Church have traditionally, at the Strawberry Festival, served ice cream and strawberries. And it's they're famous for it. Well, every year they have a debate about whether they're going to buy strawberries from the grocery store, which come from New Zealand, or whether they're going to go out and pick them from the one remaining field. And they have a debate about whether they're going to make the ice cream from scratch and crank it, or whether they're going to buy it. And every year they decide that they're going to make the ice cream and they're going to pick the strawberries and they're going to serve the real thing, so that the people on the island get homemade ice cream and island strawberries. And in the sermon, I was telling him about how they did this, and I said, now, you can do this in every aspect of the church's ministry. This is your job. If you can make strawberries and ice cream for this community, you can take care of the battered children in this community. And so the image of what's like you, coffee hour, that what they could do, they knew how to do things well. They knew how to get their resources together. They knew how to cook. And it's true, actually, some of you have been working in the kitchen. I mean, if you know how to cook, you can do almost anything. If you know how to cook a meal for 25 people.
For 500.
Or for 500. Now, don't you feel like you could manage a corporation? I know. I'm not sure that you'd want to, but do you feel like you could set up a soup kitchen?
Probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's one of the things you learn is you don't feed 500 people by yourself. But that's a real simple image of capability.
Maybe even back to your tree image, it's amazing what trees can do. They are often hit by lightning and live and discard the branch. They can grow around another tree. They can grow through rocks. They do amazing things to recover and to
like what?
Change
humans. Yeah, even in sterile soil. I don't know how those trees manage to grow.
Yeah, and to go through different experiences of their untree life almost, and to push into realms where you wouldn't think they could. I mean, there are some ways of carrying that out.
Yeah.
Also, I like the tree image because in fall, when the leaves change color, those colors that we see chemically are there all along, but we only see them when the chlorophyll dies. Like there's something rich imagery of the beauty that comes in that cycle, the bursting forth of color in the midst of death. You know?
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that about the chlorophyll. You were going to say something, Jacob?
Not really, but I was going to say that I appreciate the process of you focusing more on our imaging of ourselves in relation to God, because we do spend a lot of time trying to re-image God, or I mean that's really, but it's very empowering to talk about re-imaging our relationship or ourselves in mm-hmm. that relationship to God, because I think I have often been critical and do a lot of talking, even biblically, I think, about how to repicture God, which again is still outside, it's not as empowering as thinking about, I like the idea of Gardner a lot. Mm-hmm. I just like that process better. I mean, it feels good to be thinking about kind of re-imaging myself in relation to God versus trying to re-image God.
Yeah, another image of ourselves, I think it's a real simple and helpful one, is to think of ourselves as providers of hospitality in the world.